Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, which will launch an RN to BSN program in January. Practicing nurses with an associate degree can complete a Bachelor of Science in Nursing in 16 months, taking a mix of online and on-campus courses. Go to carthage.edu/BSN for more information. Welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I really appreciate the mayor of the city of Kenosha, the Honorable John Antaramian, for making time in an incredibly busy schedule to join me for a few minutes to talk about what he and his staff have been very busy with over the last few weeks. Mayor Antaramian, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you for having me.
I cannot fathom what you and your staff have experienced over the last few weeks. I wonder if you could just kind of briefly tell us what life is like and what is, in a sense, the most pressing responsibilities that you and your staff are feeling right now at this point in the city's history.
Well, the first off, when you think back of what happened, we've just gone through a very, very difficult time in our community's history, and everybody is pulling together to try to work together to solve some of the issues that we're facing, knowing that they're not going to be fast solutions to anything that we do. So part of what we've been doing is when working with clergy and others, meeting with people, talking, trying to make sure that we have better communications with a number of the different groups out there and to the public, and to make sure that people feel they have access. And so that's what we're attempting to do more and more as this process goes along. We're having the hearings that will be our next Sunday again. We'll have another one, in which case they're listening sessions, because I think one of the important aspects of what we're doing is listening to what the community has to say and looking at what modifications and changes we have to make in our community. Some of which deal with process and procedures, some of which deal with how we deal with mental health, how we deal with employment. There's just a broad range of things that we need to sit down and listen to. And the other aspect of what we're doing is looking to the future as to what we need to do to make our community a better place to live and where people have opportunity. And that is really the key, I think, as we move forward. So we need to make sure that if things are fair, that we deal with the racial issues, that we deal with economic issues, things that we've been working on for years, but we have not moved fast enough on. So we're trying to speed up some of those processes to make it so people have a better opportunity.
You were a guest on WGTD's Community Matters program not too long ago, talking about a host of issues. One of the things that I believe came up during that conversation is that this process that the city is engaged in right now was a process that was already underway following the death of George Floyd. Can you tell us how that process has changed given the incident in Kenosha with Jacob Blake? Is the process the same but accelerating, or has it broadened or deepened? How would you characterize the way in which this process is now moving in a different way than it was at the outset?
Well, I think the process has changed a little bit, but not greatly. The concept that for 4 years I've been meeting with the clergy in conversations as to different issues in the community and how we should be dealing with things. When the George Floyd situation, the George Floyd killing occurred, and that's what it was, we immediately looked to speed up some of the things that we were doing, and we created, I asked the clergy to help create some committees to look at how we do things so that we could try to get ahead of what is going on across the nation, because this is not something just happening in Kenosha. This is something that's happening all across the nation, and we need to look at what we've done well and what we haven't done well and look to change. I mean, that is what we're about. That's what we're, as government, we need to look to the future and look at what we've done and look at where we're going and look at what we need to do to change. And that's not always easy to do. But I asked the clergy to do that. I had a great deal of faith in the group of clergy I had been meeting with. They had been, as I said, meeting with me for 4 years and talking about different aspects, different projects. And I put them in a position where they are moving forward with the conceptual plans of different areas to look at, police and community relations, economics, education, leadership, you know, getting young people involved in the sense of taking over, because they're the ones who are going to have to follow and they're the ones who are going to have to do it. So that type of concept is what we were putting together as to going. Now, has it changed? Yes. The listening sessions definitely are something that was not in the original plan that we modified, because it was important for us to hear the community ahead of time. Before the committees, because the committee would be involved in the committees, but giving people the voice to speak ahead of time was something that, in the end, I thought was very, very important to change, and that's why we did that. But also, through the conversations we've had, one of the issues that really has bubbled up, and it's a little bit off the beaten path in the sense of what we're talking about, but is one that just permeates through everything, is an issue of mental health. And that has been something that, in numerous conversations I've had with people, that is a concern in this community, in dealing with mental health for individuals, that there is a major problem that has to be addressed if we're going to address some of these other issues, because it ties into education, it ties into law enforcement, it ties into all these different areas. And so that is an area that we have now kind of added to the things that we are looking at doing.
And you mean specifically access to adequate mental health care?
Absolutely. That's exactly what we're talking about. Kenosha County, and actually I'll say Kenosha County because it's not just Kenosha. Kenosha County, which we are part of, so I don't want people saying, oh, it's someone else's problem. It's all of our issues. The Kenosha County area mental health support system is in need of strengthening. And that is something that we are going to be looking at, and that's a discussion that the county has to be brought into, because the county controls the health department and all the health issues. So though we are part of the county is the entity that controls and has the money that they get from the feds or the state feds. We need to take a look at, though, is what is going on with our hospitals. What are they doing to help create some of the support systems in need? We have a lot of hospitals that have built a lot of space down here. We need to make sure that they're involved in this. Kids, which, you know, the city put in about $1.5 million into their mental health program so that they would have a facility. It's a wonderful facility. It's probably nowhere near the need that we have out there. So what is it that we need to do as a community? And as I mentioned, these groups are not pinpointing or picking on any one of them. That's not the point. The point is that we all need to start talking together as to how we're going to deal with this issue, because it's a bigger issue than I think people realize. Mm.
We're speaking with John Antaramian, the mayor of the city of Kenosha. Mr. Mayor, at the most recent listening session, probably the theme that seemed to be most predominant was the matter of trust of law enforcement. What do you see as you now have done some of this listening? What are you beginning to see a clear path forward in terms of fostering and rebuilding a sense of trust between the Black community and law enforcement?
Well, I think that you're a little soon on trying to create a pattern as to where we're going yet, because I think we've only had one major public hearing. I've had numerous meetings with individuals and small groups on the side, but as far as the public meetings have gone, we've only had one. We need to have all four so that we can put things together and determine where we need to go. But is there a need for a better relationship between law enforcement and the community? Yes. And that's something I believe that will occur as time goes on. I know that I've talked to a couple of officers as to some things that they would like to do and have some ideas of what we can do as a community to try to start putting some things together and working together with different groups. And you'll see that continually happening. And I believe you'll see certain changes made on that basis. But part of what we're doing right now is we still need to review and have started the process of reviewing policies and procedures, all the different things that need to be looked at so that when the committee meetings start, we can show, here's what we've done, here's what things, and then we can look at what other communities have done differently, what someone else has done better. The one thing you learn as mayor is that it's okay to look at other cities and steal their ideas. people do it to us, we do it to them. So we will look at what other communities have. The U.S. Conference of Mayors has put out a report on best practices. We'll review those best practices, see which ones we already have implemented and which ones we have not, what changes we may need to make, and also some changes that we may have to be asking from the state level as to training and different aspects of that, because we don't control everything. Certain aspects of training are controlled by the state. Certain aspects of training we can control. So we can bring in more training, but there's a standardized training that goes on. So all of that will be looked at. All of that will be reviewed, looked at by the committees, ideas given, what we might do to change. All of that will occur as we move through this process with the clergy.
I think the way I phrased the question and your thoughtful answer points to one dilemma, which is balancing a sense of urgency with a sense of calm, rational, thorough process. I mean, to not rush to piecemeal solutions, to try to be thorough and meticulous, but moving, in a sense, aggressively because of a sense of urgency in all of this. I think it's not easy to have the perfect balance of that.
It's never easy to have that perfect balance, but I will tell you, in many of my meetings with a number of people who are unhappy with the situation that has occurred. No, I shouldn't say unhappy. That's the wrong word. But people who are concerned about what is going on in our community. I think people don't realize that a lot of them, and I would probably say the most of them, are looking for change that's going to make a difference. So I have more faith in people, I think, than a lot of people look at things and say, oh, we have to do something quickly because someone's going to respond in a negative way. I have more faith in these young people that a lot of them want change. And, yes, they're boisterous and they're noisy and they want to see change happen fast. But in conversations with a number of them, I think that you're going to find that the majority of them are looking at what can be done on a long-term basis to really make change. So I have more faith. I believe that, first off, this community is a good community, and we will rebound from this. I also believe that there are a lot of people who are very upset in the community but are willing to work to try to fix the problems and to solve the issues. So I have faith in that basis. So, yes, there are going to be some who aren't going to be happy that we're moving too slow. I think that you're going to find that a majority of the individuals, including protesters and everything else, who also want change to occur in a way that is lasting. And so I have more faith in people on that basis. So I think we'll be fine. I think we'll be able to work through this. We'll find a reasonable way of moving forward, and I believe that will happen, and I have every faith in the community that that will happen.
Before we let you go, could you say a quick word about the rebuilding process here in Kenosha? I'm speaking now in more physical terms. Just give our community a sense of what resources are available and what the process is in terms of the rebuilding of what was destroyed.
Well, I think there's two issues of rebuilding. One is people, and I think we sometimes forget. We look at rebuilding of buildings, but we don't always think of the damage to people. And when I say damage to people, I don't necessarily mean people who are hurt, though that too is an issue that we need to be aware of. But just the psyche of people as to that they're important, and that this is not just buildings and things that have to be rebuilt. We need to look at what we're doing overall as a community to help redevelop and rebuild the young people who are here, that they know that there's a future. So putting that one aside, putting that one done first. Secondly, if you're looking at the issues of rebuilding in the sense of the community itself for buildings, I believe that yesterday, and I don't know if it's been released yet, but I believe yesterday the state made some votes on a number of issues in WEDIC, and if that's not out yet, we are waiting. But the governor had made a minimum commitment of $1 million. Hopefully that's going to be more than that, but again, I'm not sure how the vote went yesterday. But there's definitely $1 million that is going to be coming to the business community in Kenosha. Our hope, we've asked for considerably more than that. I'm not going to go into our wish list, but we made a request for more money. We made a request for how some of those funds would be used for the small businesses to make sure that it not just didn't go to buildings, but to some of the small businesses that were injured. We made requests to do grants along with loans. Those are things that we've requested. Now, I can't tell you what's going to happen as of yet because I believe they were working on it yesterday. So within the next day or so, I'm assuming the governor will come out with what they finally decided to do.
Well, we, of course, appreciate all that you're doing, you and your staff, and everyone concerned about the well-being of this great city. John Antaramian, the mayor of the city of Kenosha, I appreciate you making time for this conversation. Thank you so much. Best wishes.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And for part two of today's morning show, I am really honored to be able to speak for a few minutes with Tamron Hall, who has just won an Emmy for Outstanding Informative Talk Show Host, and her second season of her talk show has just begun. And I am really happy that we can talk with Tamron Hall for a couple of minutes about what it means to talk about race in 2020 and some of the difficult conversations that have to happen. Tamron Hall, we welcome you to the morning show and congratulations on your Emmy.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Some headlines have been made recently, and we don't need to explore this in detail, but concerning an interview that you did on your program with Stassi Schroeder around issues of race. And I heard your response to some of the controversy, and I appreciated what you said about how you believed you'd had a fair and open conversation, difficult but fair. And for the city of Kenosha, that's really what we're engaging in right now, some conversations that are difficult and yet one hopes will lead to something very positive. What would be your advice in terms of what it means to have difficult but fair conversations about race?
You know, I wish I could give specific advice because I think it's really a case-by-case basis because we are together unpacking so much. I spent a lot of time in Kenosha. I lived in Chicago for 10 years. I have friends who raised their children in Kenosha. In fact, two people I work with at WFLD Fox and who became great friends, and we've rooted each other on for many years. They happen to be white, and we were like sisters and are like sisters and brothers. And for me, I think that's the problem. We look for a template rather than looking at the person. What is the individual conversation we want to have? On my show, I recently said, I wish we would stop or people would stop using this hashtag Karen, because that's giving this kitschy name to a behavior or a conversation that we need to have. What does it mean when someone accuses another person of being a Karen? What's at the heart of that meme versus this quick out of naming or labeling versus talking? So if I, in a word, I think openness. I think you have to be unafraid to admit that we're not getting it right and know that we're trying to get it right for our kids and the next generation. I went 49 years without being a mom. I'm a mom now. I want to get it right for Moses, but I want to get it right for myself and for my friends and for the people who watch our show.
Nicely put. I want to also commend you on doing such a fine job with continuing your show during COVID. I think a lot of television programs have really struggled in terms of what to be and how to do what they do during this time of COVID and physical distancing. What have you and your staff talked about, and what do you think is the key to why you have been so successful in continuing your program through this time of COVID?
We've made a point of having this wellness conversation with each other, checking in. When I started this second season with my team, our first meeting, like so many others, were on Zooms. And I'd never even heard of Zoom prior to the COVID pandemic hitting us, COVID-19. And I said to them, listen, this is a job. This is how we pay our bills. This is our passion. But at the end of the day, I know that we're worried about our parents. When will we see our family members again? Should I send my child to school or not? Those are the things that matter most to me in your lives. This show, it's a show. We can figure out other occupations if we need to. But our families mean the most to all of us. And I wanted them to understand that at all costs, this is about protecting our family. And then we'll figure out the rest. If we have to scale back the show, we will. If we have to figure out shifts for people, we will. If your child happens to be crying in the background, that's cool. That's okay with me because mine is probably 3 inches away from me, you know, and I'm keeping him quiet by watching an iPad with his favorite cartoon. So I try to approach it with the team exactly how I feel at this moment. I feel vulnerable. Some days I'm afraid. Some days I'm optimistic that we're going to get through this and everything will be okay and this will be like the end of the movie Sixth Sense. It was all a dream. It wasn't real, you know. And I just, for my team, felt it was important that we acknowledge the personal side of this journey over the professional side. And that's ironic given that millions of people are out of a job. And I don't take for granted one single moment what this job means to me and my team. But our families mean much more, and I wanted to convey that to them. So we've put together the show. We had maybe 5 or 6 iPads. We used my son's baby monitor. I was hunkered down in the basement. We would start calls, and the Zoom connection wouldn't work, and we just keep hammering away at it. And now we're back in our studio with a smaller staff. We're tested multiple times a week. Everyone is required to wear a mask and a shield. We're taking all of the precautions that have been laid out by the CDC and also our company, who's been phenomenal and responsible in their reaction to us wanting to get back in the studio. Mm.
Well, congratulations again on the Emmy Award, Tamron Hall, the host of one of the most popular talk shows on television, and best wishes to you and everyone with Tamron Hall.
The same to you. Thank you so much.
Take care. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And I'm not sure I can put into words just how excited I am about the next few minutes of The Morning Show as I speak with none other than the super nanny, Jo Frost. She is known not only here but all around the world as one of the most respected experts when it comes to parenting. And she draws upon many years of work as a nanny. And on the study that she has done, she's authored a number of books and, of course, headlined a number of different series on television. The most recent, which has just debuted on Lifetime TV, is called Jo Frost, Nanny on Tour. And we have her for a few minutes to talk to us on The Morning Show today. Jo Frost, we welcome you.
Thank you very much for having me.
I am really excited about this. You began work in real life as a nanny at the age of 18. And I'm anxious to know what you think was valuable about the experience of being a nanny versus being an actual parent. I suspect, of course, it's not at all the same thing being a nanny and being a parent, but probably something about the position of nanny gave you a certain perspective when it comes to the matter of raising children. What do you think that special perspective of the nanny is?
Well, if I can just take you back a step with respect to the importance of a dedicated professional nanny, which is a very desirable, dedicated, honorable profession, which allows you to have this wonderful, intimate friendship with the children, your little charges, and the family that you work for. It's very different to how Americans call child carers nannies. And there's a very big difference because Americans use the word nanny a lot, you know, for a mother's help or somebody who babysits a child. But when you're a professional, dedicated nanny, you really are there for well, over 10, 12 hours a day, helping families on daily schedules. And your whole intention is the emotional and social and physical welfare of the children and the family. So the work is one where you are educating the children and taking on board the psychological kind of impact of your teachings and the care and duty of a family. So first and foremost, that to me has given me the life experience in being able to work with different families as I entered my professional career as a nanny, which then led, after many years underneath my cap of life experience, of being able to troubleshoot and help families with targeted issues. And so, you know, the professional nanny wouldn't do per se as what I do now. You know, they are there to provide a service, but to be very in an integral way there for the family. Really, after my experience, I got into consulting and, you know, targeted issues where I was able to use my experience and foundation of being a professional nanny to consult and troubleshoot and help families in the capacity that you see the format of the Super Nanny show. And so that's how it lends itself when we watch the show to mesh this experience of being a professional nanny and then moving into a space of consulting and helping families in targeted present issues to now a much bigger platform in being able to help families on a global level. But that life experience gave me the certainly the knowledge for different circumstances and all walks of life, you know, with respect to how you were able to objectively look at a circumstance, use your experience to fundamentally lay down principles or techniques and how to bring a family together. And that's the experience, the life experience. And it's also my makeup of who I am as well. You know, my intuitiveness in working with a family and being able to bridge the gap and to I've always connected with children in a very unique way where I was able to bring that to my life's work now in helping families under the capacity that you see every week, whether it's, you know, a Super Nanny show or, a Nanny Joe on tour, you know, whatever the format may be. But it's one that I've always enjoyed. I'm very passionate about it. It allows me to be able to step back and teach families to do the same because, you know, a lot of families emotionally can be connected. But that's not to say that we do not feel emotionally as well. It's just that, you know, we're in a space professionally of being objective, of being able to see what the problem may be.
Right. And I know that
doing a little bit more.
And this new series, of course, you are targeting some very tough problems such as ADHD or a situation where maybe a new mom is facing postpartum depression. And so we will be excited to and anxious to see you bring your expertise to some very vexing and difficult questions and challenges. One of the things that is especially impressive about what you do is the far-reaching scope of what you do, not only in your own native Britain or in Europe or in the United States, but really all around the world. And I think there's something kind of astonishing about that because we sometimes think of parenting styles and parenting issues being very, very different, whether you live in London or Tucson, Arizona, or Tokyo, Japan, or Brisbane, Australia. Clearly, there are fundamental elements that, in a sense, are universal, that are truly global, and it must be invigorating for you to bring your expertise into all these different places.
Oh, absolutely. It's very spiritually rewarding to use the power of TV, the medium, the vessel of TV, or through radio broadcast or, you know, books, in being able to bring your wisdom and expertise of over 33 years.
Exactly.
You know, and to be able to parlay that into different mediums to help families is incredibly powerful and very rewarding in the impact that it can make. And certainly you put the experience, the life experience, together with the era of technology and social media and mesh those together, the reach is absolutely phenomenal.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Family.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah,
you know?
you're touching all kinds of lives. It would be good, I think, to spend a moment talking about the special challenges and stresses that many parents, probably just about all parents, are facing right now in this time of the COVID-19 pandemic. In a nutshell, what would be a couple of your words of wisdom for parents who are finding this new normal to be very difficult when it comes to parenting their children?
I would say that the most important thing to do, because 2020 has put us all in a space of not being able to run from the issues we may have found challenging in our own home, is to find, you know, the 10 seconds of courage to open up the door and to address those, because it's teaching us to really take a look at the highlighted moments that have shown up now that need to be addressed. And we, you know, as somebody who's traveled to 48 states of this country and has spent the last 16 years helping American families, I certainly can say that there were 1,000 excuses of why situations couldn't be changed. You know, working too late, our paths are crossing, we don't have time, we're running too many schedules for the children, too many extra curriculums and activities, and now we have the time. It's brought its new challenges with homeschooling and, you know, families being in spaces where eternally you're, you know, trying to work out your privacy and boundaries and bubbles and mental health issues. But I think it's important to go with the ebb and flow. You know, it's like this is a time now where we don't meet fire with fire. We become fluid. We become water. We learn to adapt and accept the situation that we're in right now, and then to do the best that we can in creating an environment that's more peaceful and more harmonious for all of us. And that may mean for a lot of families that we have to lower our expectations, look at the framework of our routine, recognize that we are not going to have an ideal situation here, and that we are only human beings, and your main obligation and duty right now is to keep your family safe and alive, because there is no expiration date. And so psychologically, it's been very difficult for many families because, you know, if we are set with a project or a task or something that's difficult, it's a phase that one may go through and seem to feel like they're coming out the other end with the tools, right? In this circumstances, there are the tools in being able to help families with those highlighted issues that have turned up. But there are also the reality of knowing that we're in this for a bit, you know, and this is not the sprint, this is the marathon, and we do have to let go and surrender to what we cannot control. We have to recognize that it's not going to be perfect every day, because that doesn't exist. So let's celebrate imperfection. Let's make sure that we can take care of ourselves and our family, and stay present, and stay present with recognizing, and this is not to minimize the horrific numbers of people who have lost their lives and the circumstances right now that we are having to live in, but to recognize gratitude, the importance of being thankful for what we have right now and where we are at right now. And I think that's really important for our mental health in how we move forward every day with our families, because we are teaching ourselves that discipline, but we are also leading by example for our children as well. And that has to count for a lot, you know. So it's not to minimize, it's not to say that the struggle's not there, but it is to say that only we will be the carpenters in our family's life in carving out the right, we're taking 15 minutes. And we're just, you know what, just go and play and do whatever you want to do. You know, we don't have to do school right now. And mum's going to take a break for a moment here, because I've always said to families that when you're at home raising children or you're juggling work and family life, sort of nobody really blows the whistle and says, okay, guys, off you go for an hour lunch break. You know, leave the kids there. It will be fine. You know, no, we can't do that. You know, the kids are there. We need to find the pockets of going 80 miles an hour and then saying, right, we're going to drop down to 50. You know, and that's what we need to recognize in ourselves. And I do think right now that mentally it's very challenging for all of us. However, we all know that that tough adversity, if we can use the tools and the techniques and adjust and accept and let go, we'll all be better for it next year.
Yeah, for
we'll
sure.
We'll be much better.
For sure.
We'll be stronger, more resilient, yes. You know?
Absolutely. Joe Frost is known as the Super Nanny, and her new television series on Lifetime is called Super Nanny on Tour. And we spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with one of the most gifted and capable writers when it comes to young readers, Valerie Tripp, probably best known for all the work that she has done on the American Girl series. But here on the morning show to talk about an exciting new adventure for her in collaboration with National Geographic, a new series called Izzy Newton and the Smart Squad. And Valerie Tripp, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me here today.
Right. A couple of overarching questions, and then we'll get to Izzy Newton in a moment. I read in your biography that you were a philosophy major in college. I wonder if you can trace the line from being a philosophy major to the kind of writing that you have done in your very successful career.
Greg, I love you for asking that question, because, you know, when I told my parents I was going to be a philosophy major, I remember my dear father saying, well, are you going to get a job as a philosopher? I don't think they have jobs for philosophers. But here's what it was, Greg. I had to translate the philosophies that I read were so complicated. I had to translate them for myself into very simple, direct and clear language in order to remember them. And both in the case of writing for American Girl, where I was taking complicated history concepts and economic or social and political concepts, and, if you will, translating them and stating them in the clearest, most direct form for my readers who were, you know, 8 to 10 years old, the philosophy stood me in very good stead. The practice that I had stood me in very good stead. And now, writing this STEM-based series for National Geographic Kids, it's the same thing. I'll take a very complicated scientific concept and say, okay, we have to make this not only clear, so my reader who's 8 to 12 years old will understand it, but I have to make it matter to my reader as well. Because when you have an emotional connection, that's when you remember something that you have read. So to tell you the truth, that background in philosophy and reading very complicated things and trying to state them clearly and simply turned out to be, surprisingly, an excellent background for exactly what I do, writing for children.
Thank you
so much for asking that. No one's ever asked me about that before.
I'm glad I asked. I also want to ask you about the fact that you also write for reading textbooks, and that connection, of course, is much clearer. But I suspect that there are connections even beyond the obvious in terms of writing for reading textbooks and then writing books that young people read.
Yes, it helps me very much to be aware of, for example, the reading level that is appropriate for a child, so in terms of vocabulary or concept difficulty, because you don't want to insult your reader. I have a lot of respect for my readers. I don't want to insult my reader by having it be simplistic, and I want it to really resonate with the reader of exactly the age group that I'm writing for. They are my inspiration. My readers are my inspiration. Quite literally, that's where my ideas come from speaking to my readers whenever I have a chance to do so. And I want to be sure that I'm writing at the level that will interest and engage and absorb and stretch them just a tad, you know, just stretch you just a little bit.
Was it National Geographic who came to you with a very specific invitation, or did this collaboration begin in a little more sort of open-ended fashion and then eventually take the shape that it has with Izzy Newton?
Okay, well, here's the truth. A friend whom I adore, who's a librarian at a school, called me and said, "Oh, Valerie, my speaker for tomorrow, you know, can't come. Could you possibly come and just speak as a substitute, last-minute substitute?" So I said, sure, because I love Carolyn. And that's where I met Rebecca Baines, who was the head of children's publishing at National Geographic Kids. And she said, "Would you ever be interested in writing a fiction series?" And I said, "Are you kidding? It would be a dream come true. I would love to do that." So National Geographic, Becky already had the idea for the series in mind, and she had already come up with this really fun idea of having the titles be plays on words. The first words, the first book's Absolute Hero, which is a play on Absolute Zero, and the mystery is about why the school is so freezing cold, and also there's a mystery about why there's a chilliness in one of the friendships. So National Geographic Kids already had the structure of the series, and when they came to me, I said, "Oh, I would love to do this," and it has been a pure pleasure to work with National Geographic Kids.
I think a lot of us who don't know anything about the business of writing for young readers assume that the most important thing is choosing the words. I mean, that the words not be too complicated or not too long or whatever, or the sentences not too long. But I'm sure there is more to it, especially when you've crafted this book, Izzy Newton and the Smart Squad. What kinds of things did you think about in terms of the way these stories should be shaped and crafted? I mean, the storyline, what is the key to connecting with readers of this age?
Well, I the first and most important thing, as I said, was that I want my readers to become friends with these characters so that they will care about what's going on with them. And I wanted sort of the through thread of all of the stories to be about kindness and about functioning as a group and respecting differences in a group. These are five very diverse girls, and sort of metaphorically, the fact that they're interested in different fields of science shows you that they really come at the world in very different directions, and they learn to respect those differences and solve the mysteries by pooling those various talents, and really they benefit by how their differences. That was a very important point that I wanted to make. I also wanted to make a point about failures, that failure is a good thing. As a writer, I have to write my stories four or five times before I get them right. And scientists, and certainly my five characters, their experiments fail constantly. And you can learn a lot from a failure. So I try to start with an emotional kind of start, heart and soul first, and then go to the brain and cerebral part. I try to engage them and know what really matters to my readers of this age. I was so helped by the fact that one of the ways I did my research was by having lunch with a bunch of girls. We called ourselves the Lunch Bunch, and I would bring cookies, and they would tell me what was going on with them in school and facing the challenges of middle school and the way middle school is different from elementary school and the challenges of being 10 going on 11 and 12 and how your life is different. Things are a little more complicated now. And that group of girls gave the stories such authenticity. I couldn't have manufactured that. You can't sprinkle authenticity on afterward. It has to be organic. The story has to be nourished by the realism and the stories that these real girls told me about what was mattering to them. I'm just endlessly grateful to them because they were the heart and soul, really, of these stories.
A last quick question. This book and the whole series is labeled as STEM-based, and certainly science is a very strong ingredient. Is that something that is of a personal interest to you, or is that a little bit of a stretch for you to be writing a book in which the sciences are such an important element?
Well, I mean, I always loved science. I especially loved physics when I was in school. But one of the points that I wanted to make was science doesn't only happen in a lab. And certainly now we're all part of a living science experiment, are we not? That we've learned how important it is to wash our hands and wear masks. We're learning about engineers reconfiguring our public spaces to keep us safe. I want to say to girls, when you care for your pet, when you are careful and not wasting water and you're protecting the environment, when you're designing something, when you're doing digital art, that's STEM. It's not some arcane thing that's just tucked away on a shelf somewhere. You're a scientist already. You're living science every single day. All of us are. So we have to just, you know, sort of blow the dust off any kind of stereotype about what science is or what girls do or what boys do. Or that, if I want to say to my readers, if you're interested in this, if this is your passion, don't you let anyone talk you out of it.
From National Geographic, Izzy Newton and the Smart Squad, the first book titled Absolute Hero, Valerie Tripp, the author. Valerie Tripp, thank you so much. Best wishes, and keep on writing.
Thank you very much, Greg. What a pleasure to talk to you.
Bye-bye. Tomorrow's morning show, in terms of broadcast, will be preempted by NPR's live coverage of the memorial service for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. However, tomorrow's morning show interview will still be available in podcast format, and it will be another interview with Mark Cushman about his books called These Are the Voyages, the latest books of which examine the 1970s, that decade right after Star Trek the original series was canceled. It was in this decade that the Star Trek phenomenon, as we know it today, was truly born. This weekend on the podcast version, I'll be, among other things, rebroadcasting a conversation from 2004 with Edward Conlin, the author of one of the most illuminating books about police officers ever written, a book called Blue Blood. Next week, Monday, we will finally get to share an interview that was originally scheduled to air yesterday, but preempted by NPR's coverage of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's body lying in state. That book, The Wax Pack, On the Road, Open Road in Search of Baseball's Afterlife by Brad Balouchian. Next week's schedule will also include the monthly visit of Art Sear from Carthage College. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, which will launch an RN to BSN program this January. Practicing nurses with an associate degree can complete a Bachelor of Science in Nursing in 16 months, taking a mix of online and on-campus courses. For more information, you can go to carthage.edu/BSN. We're approaching 9 o'clock.